Welcome everyone to another episode of Imperfect Leaders. Failure is a beautiful opportunity, to quote today's special guest, U.S. Representative Dean Phillips. Even though he recently suspended his long shot campaign to become the next president of the United States, he openly admits that he learned more about himself as a leader, as an innovator, and as a human being than he ever had before. He's hoping his run for president inspires other innovators and entrepreneurs to throw their hats in the ring and shake things up in American politics. It's true, failure can be a beautiful opportunity for self-aware leaders willing to reflect and admit their own imperfections and try new things. So I hope you'll enjoy today's conversation with my new friend, Dean Phillips. And so I know this isn't easy to talk about, but how did you feel when ultimately you did decide to pull out and suspend your campaign? I mean, what were those raw emotions like? And you're a guy that's been successful in so many huge things your entire life. So how did it feel not to win and to actually bow out of the campaign? It's something that is so incredibly important to you.
You know, Jeff, one of my discoveries in my lifetime is that if you don't learn from failure, then you failed. And when I was a younger man, I wanted to avoid failure at all costs. And I generally took the easy path. I didn't take a lot of risks. And I failed plenty of times, but it affected me in a much different way than it affects me now. And, you know, when I decided to make this run, which again was going to be unlikely, no question, a long shot, you know, I recognized, and this is just old fashioned wisdom, I didn't want to be an old man on my deathbed wondering, looking back, what if I had, you know, what would it have been like? What if I had succeeded? How would I teach my children, grandchildren? And I realized that, you know, failure is relative. I really have come to believe that those who don't try, those who don't jump in, pursue discomfort, take the hard path, that's failure. I wouldn't consider my campaign a failure because the real mission was to demonstrate that despite great odds, despite a lot of disgust and dismay and people trying to prevent the very mission, that we did it. And that alone was satisfactory. And I'm glad that I actually pursued principle, because my whole point was to demonstrate to my colleagues, most of whom will never, ever, ever get out of line in the spirit of self-preservation, that once in a while you got to do it. And that not only will you survive, you can thrive, and you can demonstrate how people should lead. So in that respect, it was a success. Mm-hmm. But of course, nobody likes to fail. I put a lot of my own personal resources into it, my time, my treasure. I don't like letting people down, people who had invested in me. Any leader knows that. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't easy. And I think the best lesson I can learn from these experiences is that when you live a life of constantly having a bucket list, things that you wish to achieve, it makes failure actually a beautiful opportunity, because then you move on to your next pursuit. It's people who don't want to pursue their aspirations or their dreams that I think are the saddest in the world. So in a way, I kind of reconciled the end of the campaign with the belief and recognition that now I can pursue other ways to serve my country, pursue my own interests, and try to make the world a little bit of a better place.
And you talk about your colleagues, how do you think your constituents and colleagues and hardcore supporters feel about all this? I mean, what do you think they think you did right and maybe that you messed up or got wrong during this process?
Yeah. You know, Jeffy, we have to separate those people into two categories. One are activists, the people that are just loyalists, party loyalists, devotees, party line folks. And then the mass, well, actually, I should say three buckets. And then mass number of voters, the majority of the country, I'd say. And then there are some people who are just completely disinterested altogether. You know, in the first bucket, the activists, they were upset. They believe in a party system that you wait in line, you wait your turn. You don't do anything to disrupt and never, ever, ever take on an incumbent. Then you've got the massive middle, if you will, people who vote but don't pay a lot of attention. And you know, for the most part, they were quite supportive. The most supportive people were the people who pay little attention, because they see, at least in my campaign, someone who was taking on great personal risk, was willing to go against his party, and I think recognize in a very base level the need to disrupt on occasion, which is how I spent my whole business career, disrupting duopolies. Mm-hmm. You know, Belvedere was a disruption of Absolut and Stoli vodka. Mm-hmm. Talenti was a disruption of Ben and Jerry's and Häagen-Dazs. And in a way, My campaign was a disruption of the two-party duopoly, which I intend to rectify at some point in my life, I hope. So the response was an array. My colleagues in Congress were privately complimentary, publicly not so much. And therein lies the crux of my whole mission, Jeff, was to demonstrate the hypocrisy on the right, the hypocrisy about an overwhelming majority of my colleagues in Congress finding Donald Trump a despicable man, but then publicly, when they need his endorsement and when the cameras are on and they need votes, then they're effusively complimentary. Same thing with my Democratic colleagues, almost all of whom were very troubled by the fact that Joe Biden decided to run again. He implied he wouldn't. We all know he's a man of a lot of years and a lot of wisdom, but probably shouldn't have run again. Privately acknowledging that, publicly saying something totally different. And there's why I think Americans have lost faith in their government, because of that really obvious and public disconnect between private conversations and public articulations. And by the way, that's transferable to any leadership position. When people don't believe you, they don't trust you, they will never follow.
So interesting. And so if you look back now, and I know that you're just now starting to reflect, it hasn't even been a full week yet, but have there been any lessons that have surfaced? I mean, what have you actually learned from this experience?
Yeah. So, you know, probably the biggest takeaway was that you can never achieve a great success without planning. And in this case, I had 2 weeks, literally 2 weeks, to plan a presidential campaign. It had never been done before. Nobody would be so foolish to do it. But this was an issue of meeting the moment, not having the luxury of time, resources, people, experience. And it was a different kind of mission in that respect. But I'd surely learned that in the absence of preparation, of great people, of time, of research, you know, it's almost destined to be a failure, no matter what you're pursuing. And that's probably my most important advice to anybody planning anything really important, to take the time necessary to do it well, give it great consideration, and most of all, have the best people at the table. Now, my circumstance didn't allow any of that. And would I have done a lot differently? Yeah, I would have done a lot differently. Mm-hmm. When you run for office, unlike running a business, the pursuit itself is so consuming that one cannot be an operator at any level whatsoever. And that's true in a presidential campaign. I think my biggest regret was not employing my own strategic sensibilities and my own, which is where my strengths generally lie. Mm-hmm. And the absence of that made it less of an authentic campaign about me and who I am and what I stand for and my policies than I would have liked. And that was a disconnect that I regret, but not something I probably could have rectified in light of the fact that I only chose to run when nobody else would stand up and do it. And when I say nobody else, Jeff, I called Governor Whitmer, Governor Pritzker. I made a public call to people like Gavin Newsom and Vice President Harris. Anybody.
Did they even return your calls?
And well, they would any other day, I'm sure, but not then, because they knew what I was calling about. And people are so concerned about losing the support of the party for their future aspirations that they didn't even want to talk about it. And that's why I decided someone had to do it. And that's why it took, you know, I had only 2 weeks to spare, but that's what I would do differently. Plan better, prepare better. Name recognition absolutely matters. Donald Trump has wanted to do this his whole life. Mm-hmm. That's what that TV show was about. And if you don't have name recognition, good luck in running for a national public office, because if the media doesn't get behind you or your party doesn't get behind you, there is absolutely no way to generate platform. So those are lessons learned. And I got to tell you, though, the joys and the restoration of faith in our country and people really made it all worthwhile. And lastly, don't let angertainment, and I'll say it again, angertainment, don't let angertainment have you believe we are more divided than we really are, because we're not. And the great beauty of my campaign, the wisdom I took from it, was the fact that Americans at their core are really good people. They just want to be heard, they want to be affirmed, and they want to be cared about, just like any other human relationship. And that, again, transfers to any leadership position, private or public.
But why is there so much divisiveness in this country? I mean, as human beings, we all have a lot more in common than we do differences. Yeah. We, you know, we crave laughter, love, our children, sports, love. I mean, even superficial things like we want to make money and have a nice house and travel. So why the hell are we so divided?
You know, Jeff, I can only say through my personal experiences, there's a lot more money to be made in fear than there is in optimism. And that's part of the human condition. We will sacrifice anything to preserve ourselves. By the way, that's the issue in politics, self-preservation over principle. The same is true in the political realm, in the media world. There's a lot of money to be made when you make people afraid. Republicans have done it quite well. Democrats do it actually quite well too. You need a boogeyman. And people are attracted, their eyeballs are attracted to something that warns them of impending danger. You know, every time a newscast does a great story, a happy, feel-good story, it doesn't attract many eyeballs. And I can tell you from personal experience, there's a perverse reward system in Congress, and that's why you see more and more members of Congress acting like total jerks, bombastic, disrespectful, pompous, idiotic people who know better, but they see the reward system. So there's a lot of money to be made. Fox News, MSNBC, rake in billions of dollars a year from advertisers who know that we're much more inclined to pay attention to when there's a political episode of concern, God forbid, a plane crash, a train crash, than we are to the happy stories. And that's why you'll only find about 30 seconds of a happy story at the end of the nightly news, because frankly, if it was all happy, people don't pay attention. And I think therein lies the real challenge. People ask me all the time, how are we going to rectify that? Well, you can't rectify the human condition. You can do your best. And that's a tough one, especially in a country that values free speech the way we do. But that's the great challenge we face right now is fear always seems to overcome optimism when it comes to politics.
What about, you know, back in the old days, you and I remember, but what was it, Ted Koppel, Spire, like a point counterpoint. Yeah. Are there any shows like that, or would something like that work in today's culture?
Yeah, I'm so glad you mentioned that. As I think about my future, one thing I would love, and because I was the vice chair of the Problem Solvers Caucus here in the U.S. Congress, I not only do I count a number of Republicans among my dear friends, I've had the opportunity to debate and deliberate and actually then come to conclusions on how to solve problems. So I know we have a cohort of people in Congress that would be willing to do it. I would love to see a weekly or monthly nationally televised, thoughtful, old school debate between a Democrat and Republican or Libertarian and Independent. Yeah.
I mean, I'd watch it.
I'd watch it too. And I think my belief is that time is coming again where people are hungry for that debate, are unclear as to what the truth is and want to see it portrayed in a way that's not like a debate that we see where eight candidates are on a stage and they have 30 seconds. I'm talking about an old school, maybe single topic debate, where you have people of competence and decency doing what we're supposed to do. By the way, it would be educational because we have a whole number of generations of Americans who've grown up not seeing anything but dysfunction in politics. So it is possible. I would love to see it. And maybe that's a grand opportunity to show just enough competition and maybe aggression, but complemented with decency in a way that Americans would really appreciate. I think it would make us a better country.
Yeah, I agree. I love it. I hope that you do something like that or someone does. And okay, enough about your imperfections. I don't mean to beat a dead horse, but let's talk about it. You also have a hell of a lot of incredible strengths. Like you say, you know, you're a brilliant strategist. You're a world-class problem solver. You're passionate. You care deeply about really important things. Clearly, you have strong empathy and you really know how to connect with people in a genuine and authentic way. But this is just my perception. I mean, how do you see yourself as a leader? You know, what's your style? And in your mind, what are your key leadership strengths?
Yeah. And Jeff, I'd have to say empathy. It is probably what's most fully baked into me as a human being. I think sometimes it can actually be detrimental. When I think about my own strengths and weaknesses, empathy can sometimes be consuming when you start making decisions too much with your heart and not enough with your head. That's why, by the way, and to me, that great solution is you have to complement, great leaders always complement themselves with great people around them and ones who particularly satatisfy your deficiencies. I've got a brother, my brother, Tyler. He's an anesthesiologist. His life is dedicated to risk management. His job is to keep people alive when they're under anesthesia. So we are great brothers because I'm the risk taker and he's the risk manager. And we are almost extreme sometimes. So having that complementary fraternity, if you will, is a great example of how I try to complement my deficiencies. But I lead with empathy. And I think that is the most underrated, most important attribute of a great leader of anything. By the way, I think Joe Biden, I would consider that his superhero strength, if you will. I would consider that, unfortunately, Donald Trump's greatest deficiency is the inability to look at anything through the lens of anyone but himself.
So do you
And I
think
think.
that do you think Donald Trump lacks empathy? And when I think of empathy, I think of, the ability to put yourself in other people's shoes and actually understand what they're thinking, and also maybe a level two empathy, understand or feel what they're feeling. Do you think that he, that Trump lacks empathy, or that he is able to understand what people are thinking, but just doesn't care or realize it serves his own agenda if he does, what he wants, regardless of how other people feel?
I think it's a disability of his, and I think a blind spot, and I think it's one he does not want to acknowledge. But I sat across the table with him in the White House for an hour, and I saw a man, in my estimation, who simply lacks the genetic ability to empathize with other people, and to ask questions to understand how they feel. And in my estimation, it's one thing to be a business leader, a nonprofit leader, but to be the president of the United States of America, there is no more important attribute, in my estimation, than empathy, because we are a system of self-governance in which the people select their leader. It is easy for those who lack empathy to pull the wool over people's eyes, distract them, and I think he has, but that's my belief. And I think in some cases, Joe Biden is on the opposite end of that spectrum. I think he's a man of such extraordinary empathy that sometimes not quite as objective, perhaps, as he should be. And
So just so I understand, so being on either side of the pole of like having no empathy or too much empathy can be somewhat detrimental as a leader.
no question.
In President
And
Biden's case, because it sort of bleeds into compassion and it prevents him from making some of those tough interpersonal decisions that he should probably be making. And with Trump's, in Trump's situation, it actually prevents him from understanding how people care and feel.
exactly. And that's why, in a way, their deficiencies are somewhat complementary. There's no question whatsoever. But this, this old, it's the old-fashioned battle between one's head and one's heart. And great leaders have to employ both. And it's complicated sometimes, and especially when a specific individual story really deeply affects you, a personal experience. One has to separate people from issues a lot when you are the leader, when you are the final decision maker. And that's not an easy task when you literally, have the weight of the world on your shoulders.
And so let's, going back to our old point to counterpoint crossfire idea, what do you think that next debate of Biden and Trump will be like?
First of all, it saddens me, but I'm not sure there will be a debate. I believe that we might see the first presidential election in our lifetimes in which there will not be a head-to-head debate between the two major party candidates, which I think is a dereliction of duty. I think it's actually something that we in Congress should address. There should be at least a singular opportunity or form by which American voters can assess the leading candidates in a head-to-head matchup. Why someone wouldn't debate is reason for speculation. If they do, it's going to be quite a spectacle, unfortunately, because of course we know how Donald Trump acts on that stage, and we know that Joe Biden, a man of decency and integrity, but at an age and stage where his communication abilities have declined, it will be complicated to watch. But I do think it's important, and I think Americans should be really concerned if we start a new norm where there is no head-to-head debate. And frankly, it's not just a debate, it's the form itself. What I'd like to see is a town hall format.
Yes. What I was going to ask is, can you actually assess, can Americans make an informed assessment of leadership potential through 30-second sound bites on a debate
No,
stage?
it's
No
designed,
longer have it.
it's exactly. And that's another proposition of mine. I think there should be a town hall style format. Not, have a moderator, but I think the question should come from voters. I think there should be two stools. Each candidate answers the questions in a certain amount of time, but they come from the voters. And the way we do it right now, Jeff, is completely a media creation. It does not help voters. And I think there's a much better way to do it. And that's the town, there's nothing more American than a town hall format. I think it should be at least one on, one in the north, one in the south, one in the east, one in the west. Have four town halls. Invite everyday Americans on both sides of the aisle to ask the same question of both candidates and make that the standard. And that's something I'm thinking about right now, maybe even introducing something in Congress that would require some type of a head-to-head matchup between candidates before an election. Because absent that, boy, the duopoly wins, and that's disappointing.
Well, I hope that you do introduce that because I think it would be such a more effective way for Americans to actually get to understand who can be president. It's not as if there's really anything that can prepare you to be a president, but at the same time, you know, I would love to see a more interesting kind of conversation.
Well, you know, I think there are things that can prepare one for president. First of all, life experience. You know, and back to empathy. You know, I lost my father in the Vietnam War. My life was very much formed by the loss of a father who had gone to Vietnam because he earned an ROTC scholarship, needed federal government support to provide him education. And that same federal government, because of a decision made in the very body in which I now serve and in the White House, you know, took his own life. You know, my life was very much formed by that loss. You know, life experience, travel, experience around this country, business experience, nonprofit experience. There are ways through the breadth of one's experience to very much prepare, because at the end of the day, the president, and people forget this, Jeff, it is the executive office. The job is to execute the laws of the land, not to make them. It is not the chief policymaker. It is the executor of the laws of the land. And we've lost sight of what the real job of the chief executive of the United States is. And that is to hold agency leads accountable, ensure the government's operating effectively, and make sure the laws are being implemented and held accountable. So we've lost sight of that. And at the end of the day, it is all about decision making. Someone can be an outstanding human being, but absent the ability to surround yourself with great people, make good decisions, it doesn't matter what experience you have. But I'm afraid if we start having celebrity presidents, if we start having presidents that come from only political background, well, like we've always had in America, political backgrounds only, we're really missing the breadth. In fact, that's why I think we've been deficient in many cases in our leadership, because not enough people who have broad experience run for president, because who wants that nonsense is the sad truth. But I think we got to be focused on attracting those types of individuals, if not in the president's West Wing, at least the president should start surrounding him or herself through the cabinet with extraordinary able leaders, not just politicians and giving out rewards, but I mean the best and brightest American leaders. So I think there's a model moving forward that we really should be assessing differently.
Have presidents in the past surrounded themselves in a cabinet with sort of a band of experts, you know, that are outside of politics? I mean, like your good friend, Bill Ackman, you know, like just people that are very shrewd business people and good human beings and understand how things work. I mean, has that happened before?
Not enough. You know, I think you got to go back to Abraham Lincoln with a team of rivals, where a man in this case understood to keep the country together. He actually had to populate the most important table in the country with his adversaries. And it was a historic and beautiful decision for the United States. I don't think, and I've not seen evidence of any recent president using these positions in a way that I think we really need. I think it tends to be rewards and thank yous for the people who help them win. By the way, the same thing with our diplomatic corps. You know, presidents tend to give the most plum assignments, ambassadorships, to the people who raise the most money. It's not how this should work. You know, I do believe in a meritocracy. I believe we should be attracting the best and brightest. I believe that it shouldn't be a political reward. It should be a pragmatic decision about leadership. You know, why do we have a $35 trillion national debt? Why are we, you know, why do we have such bloat in our federal government? Why have we lost track of our mission? Why do we not employ zero-based budgeting? You know, why do we not have a bipartisan cabinet? These are all questions that I think we should be asking.
If you were president, would you have some of your adversaries at the table?
Absolutely. It was one of my propositions, a bipartisan cabinet of the best and brightest. I want people at that table who have led multi-billion dollar, multi-thousand person entities. I would have a bipartisan cabinet. I'd have a youth cabinet. I'd make sure the Pentagon passed an audit. I would try to employ zero-based budgeting. I'd also engage one of the big international consulting firms to assess every single federal agency to make recommendations to both the executive branch and the legislative branch about how we can improve the delivery of services through AI, technology, how we can save money, streamline the focus and mission of government, outsource what we don't do well. It's never been done that way. And I think that's because we have not had a legitimate business experience executive in a long time. In fact, Donald Trump, he's a developer and he's a only private, you know, and is a family business. It's not operating the way through accountability and oversight the way that, of course, we would like. I think it's time to have a business person in the White House who is more focused on operating the government than being the chief policymaker, which is the job of the Congress.
So when I think back on seminal experiences or crucible moments in your life that helped shape you as a leader and some of your core values, you mentioned Pia, your daughter, she overcame a serious illness and she told you she was gay. You mentioned your father, that died when you were a young kid. How did those events and other things shape who you are as a person and some of your deep core values?
As I assess my background, I grew up in a beautiful family. I was adopted when I was 3 years old. My mom remarried a wonderful man, Eddie Phillips, who brought me into an extraordinary family filled with blessings in business and philanthropy. My grandmother became Dear Abby. My aunt was Ann Landers, the advice columnist. So a lot of advice in my family. And I got lucky. And when I think about what has inspired me and what's my constitution, it's this recognition that I probably am the most fortunate gold star son or daughter in the United States of America. When you lose a father or mother in battle, very few get to lead lives like mine, filled with opportunity and blessings and love and affection. And I recognize that. And I think that probably informs who I am now more than ever. This notion that it shouldn't take a stroke of good luck or being born in the right zip code that determines where you end up in America. And as a result, I've always felt a little bit of a, I wouldn't say a burden, but an inspiration to do as much as I possibly can with the time I have. My dad died in war when he was 26 years old. I remember turning 26, Jeff, that I remember counting the days that my dad had lived, and the day that I had lived that number of days, let me tell you, the next morning was very powerful for me because I recognized that everything else was going to be a gift every single day. And it really converted me from somewhat of a passive kind of guy to a very ambitious person because I recognized how time is so short. Another example, in college, I transferred to Brown University when I was a sophomore and joined a fraternity, Sigma Chi. And somehow, some way, was in my second semester there, was elected to be our consul, our president of the fraternity. And I hadn't been there long. I hadn't been through the original orientation. I'd only been there a semester. And I wasn't prepared. And the first night when we had our kind of meeting after I'd been elected president of our fraternity, I was supposed to memorize something that I didn't. And I was humiliated. I mean, humiliated. Disappointed that I wasn't taught or counseled what I had to do, but humiliated. And I recognized that I will never be ill-prepared again, ever.
And so this was basically, you're in front of your whole Sigma Chi fraternity, and they expect you to actually have something memorized you didn't. And so you were just absolutely humiliated in front of all your new friends.
You got it. I had to read something that I should have memorized. And I'll tell you, it sounds like it's a silly antidote, anecdote.
Not at the time.
But not at the time. But it very much illuminated. Here I had been entrusted with a very, with a big job at that time for a college kid.
Sure.
And I recognized that, and my inclination was to blame the last president who didn't tell me anything I needed to know. But I tell you, what I learned is that's not anyone's job but mine.
So it goes back to preparation again.
Preparation and asking questions and being a critical thinker and being well prepared, thinking beyond tradition, knowing your role, all those things. So, when I think about good luck and preparation, that combination has very, very much influenced who I am. And I've gone through a lot of loss in my life and a lot of joy. And that empathy is a very, very constitutional part of who I am. And in business and in my political life, Jeff, I've really tried to reward people with time off, with financial rewards, with support, because the fact of the matter is, people who work with me become my family and vice versa. And when you're a leader, that's a very fine line to walk. This notion of being a leader and separating oneself from personal issues of other people, but also recognizing that in some way, shape, or form, when you're leading an organization, institution, government, your task is also to look after this family of people that are along with you. And that combination, again, of empathy, but also making tough decisions is really tough. And any great leader should be saying the same thing.
So how did these lessons that you learned in business with a couple of different companies translate into the public sphere?
Well, I think first of all, I think there's a grand opportunity. I wish in my presidential campaign I'd been able to deploy my lessons, which I said earlier, my greatest regret is that I didn't have the time not let's take the time to actually create a strategy that would kind of reposition political brand making. But there is a great opportunity and a great need, I think, to transfer some of the great consumer product marketing success stories into the political world about how, you know, if we really, because frankly, voters are consumers. You know, the difference is you're consuming a political figure, if you will, but still brand. You know, Trump has a brand, Biden has a brand. How do you build that brand? What are its attributes, right? What are the channels? What are the, you know, features and benefits, right? It's the same thing. But most of all, I think it's the lack of joy. You know, you would never see an airline building its brand by saying, you know what, fly American because we crash less than Delta, right? But that's politics, right? That's how politics operates. It's all about we're not great, but we're just a little bit better than the other terrible person, right?
Right.
And I think there's an opportunity to kind of build, you know, and that's the problem in politics. It's a multi-billion dollar industry, but populated with people who almost exclusively come from a political background rather than consumer products background. So as a result, you get the same crap. The reward system is skewed. So it's 10% commissions on TV ads, you know, which is where people spend their time. Mm-hmm. And I think it's a great opportunity to really impart some of those lessons. And that's another possibility for me down the road is to bring some of those consumer product success stories and tactics and ideas to politics, because that's how I won my race. I use the notion of everyone's invited, invitation versus confrontation. And I bought a 1960 International Harvester Metro van that symbolized the last year a Democrat had represented my district. That's what I drove around, simply listening to people, which to me is the hallmark of a great leader. Now, he or she who listens more than they talk, especially in the beginning, tend to be the people that people others want to follow. And I learned that in politics as well. Listening is a lot more powerful than speaking.
So why are so few great leaders in the business world and outside of politics willing to throw their hat in the ring for public office? I mean, we had Mark Cuban on the podcast not too long ago, and you know, guys like you and him and other. I just wish that they would get more involved.
I have to say, you know, it saddens me first and foremost, but I do understand, having now been through three congressional races, a presidential primary campaign. You know, it is such an aggressive, mean-spirited, angry industry, if you will, that people who've been successful, I think, find that they can add value in other ways. And it is something that disappoints me. I'm glad I did it. I'd do it 1,000 times again. But I do understand those in leadership positions who have done well financially and otherwise don't want to subject themselves, their families, to what happens in politics, which is a lot of truths uncovered that happen to be factual, but more often than not, a lot of things that are not factual. And that's hard. And leaders tend to have pretty big egos themselves, as you well know, Jeff. And it's not easy being attacked for things for which of which you're not guilty, let alone for things you are, exposing your family to that nonsense. And oftentimes with a very, very modest chance of success. There's a graveyard of great business leaders who thought they could become president. You know, Tom Steyer, Mike Bloomberg in the last election, right? A lot of people who think they're the thing who learn very quickly how humbling it is. So that's a problem. And I do wish that there was an opportunity to recruit, attract, and reward people who come from business backgrounds, because we need it. We don't have enough business people in the Congress right now, Jeff, to make the decisions, at least to complement the overwhelming majority of people who are just lifelong politicians. And I don't know how we fix that other than, again, I think.
Like, how do you fix it? Like, if you had to put on your problem solver's hat, like, what ideas do you have to attract more of those kinds of people?
Well, first of all, I think if we reformed gerrymandering, if we had ranked choice voting, if we changed, frankly, campaign finance laws are very significant barriers to entry, less so for business people, but such an unattractive part of the game. You know, look at when you run a business and you have to raise resources for your enterprise, that's one thing. When you've got to spend hours a day calling people for money, no fun. And I think, again, you know, it's a humbling, let me tell you, in a beautiful way, running for office is a very humbling experience, as it should be. And I think the only way to recruit more people is for people like me, David Trone, who's now running for Senate in Maryland, of course, the founder of Total Wine and Spirits, some other business people, Mitt Romney and others. You know, the sad thing is we are portrayed as being disappointed by the system, but I think we have to use that experience to try to recruit people. I think there need to be some organizations set up that, in fact, Leadership Now is one organization of former Harvard Business School students who are now in the business world that is trying to recruit, you know, more business leaders to run for office. And I think it's, you know, it's a one-on-one personal sales tactic, I think, that we have to start employing, because it is not an attractive pursuit on the outside because it is such a consuming lifestyle, Jeff. You know, even as a business leader, you know, you get time off, you have time for family, you have to create some degree of balance. In the public sphere, at least in Congress, it is so consuming, every day, every hour, filled through the lens of your political life, not to mention your official life. And it's, I think it's, there have to be some reformations in terms of the schedule, expectations, and service requirements, because there's a way to do so. And I want to play a role in doing that, because we need more business people in the U.S. Congress, because right now, I'm telling you, I bet I could find 10 people who know how to read a balance sheet in the United States Congress, and I mean it.
It's amazing. And you mentioned the campaign process itself can be so horrible that it has to have an impact on your family.
Sure.
And if I think about Pia and Daniela, like, how has being a father to two daughters, I don't know if you have other kids, but to two daughters, how does that help you become a better leader?
Well, I tell you, like any parent, I think every day about my kids. I look at my service through their eyes. You know, they're lucky young women, both of whom are now independent, working, one in Manhattan, one in Austin, Texas. But I'll tell you, as I think about their futures, as it relates to our political environment, our natural environment, the world environment, you know, it's hard not to have concerns about what type of world we're leaving for the next generation. And they very much inspired me to run for office. And of course, when I did it, they were like, are you out of your mind? And of course, when I ran for president, they thought I was out of my mind, but they're proud. And I demonstrated to them that, you know, their dad can not succeed and still make it through and put a smile on his face. And, you know, my daughters have been a very significant part of my development as a leader, of my empathy. Pia, when she was diagnosed with cancer at age 13, very much affected me, recognized how lucky we were compared to so many Americans who lack healthcare. In fact, in the hospital when she was sick, Jeff, she noticed in her hallway at Children's Hospital in Minneapolis that most of the kids there didn't have any visitors during the day. Their moms or dads had to work. They couldn't be there during the day. The kids were lonely. She actually started a little nonprofit organization called PABS Packs to hand out backpacks to kids in children's hospitals that had nothing to do. And that experience alone, you know, if you don't learn something from your tragedies, you haven't lived life well.
How did that make you feel when you saw your daughter suffering through this brutal diagnosis? And she at that time was so empathetic and sympathetic to her patients in the same room.
Yeah.
You know, she felt this tremendous sense of responsibility to try to help them. I mean, how did that make you as a father feel?
Yeah, probably one of the most extraordinary experiences of my life. And oftentimes the most tragic can become the most impactful in a positive sense. That surely was for both me and for her, you know, recognizing our good fortune, recognizing the fragility of life, recognizing how things can change in a moment's notice, and recognizing legacy, you know, and leaders, I don't think, spend enough time thinking about legacy. You know, someone told me a long time ago, Jeff, you should live the kind of life in which people ask why there is no statue of you, not why there is a statue of you. And I think that sums it up so beautifully, you know, to live the kind of life that future generations will assess by what you did, how you did it, and perhaps with the humility that you were not that well recognized for it. In fact, I love researching and looking into stories of unheralded, you know, folks who've changed the world, not just the Gandhis and the Lincolns and the like, but people who make a fundamental difference in all of our lives that are not rewarded for it. And that's the kind of life I wish more people would live, particularly leaders who are so focused too often on the bottom line and whether or not there'll be a statue, and not whether or not there wasn't, but should have.
I bet that Trump thinks about a statue of himself one day. And Trump supporters, you know, often defend him by saying, you know, I tolerate this guy and his personality because I agree with his policies. Isn't there a fundamental flaw with this line of reasoning? I mean, doesn't the president of the United States, like any leader, cast a long shadow and set the tone for the entire country in terms of what's acceptable in society and what's not?
Totally. I'm this is probably the biggest challenge I've faced in my entire life as an American, is how to reconcile that reality. I understand why people are angry. I understand why they feel dismissed, uncared for, disenfranchised, which is why I think Donald Trump found something there. And by the way, I don't think people talk about this enough, Jeff. You know, Donald Trump, when he was a developer in New York, aspired to be the creme de la creme. He wanted to join the biggest clubs and be on the social circuits and the all the galas. And he was really blackballed by a lot of the upper echelons of Manhattan society. And in no small way, I think that very much illuminates how he is connecting with people who you'd say are so antithetical to him and his lifestyle, people who do not have gold toilets at home, right? But he knows what it feels like to be the outsider, to be angry about it, to be furious that you're not being let in or being heard. And I think that is something really powerful that he discovered. And that's why a lot of people will forego his character flaws, because he is bringing to life something in them that is so anger-inspiring at a time where people are really fearful. That's the other thing, is he addresses something that is so base, we talked about earlier, is fear. And as someone who looks like he coasts through every potentially tragic circumstance, like he's Teflon, is very inspiring to a lot of people. And he never seems fragile. But that's the problem. That's how you are if you don't have empathy. You are not fragile. You don't care. And that's the irony of this whole thing. I'm troubled deeply by it. I think a lot of people make decisions based on their economic circumstances, wanting to protect as much of their resources as they can. Then they rationalize all the other stuff. Look, there are some policies of Donald Trump's that I think, especially in hindsight, were more valid than I think people gave credit for. His Abraham Accords were a heroic achievement. Focusing on the southern border, absolutely correct. Is the way he did it was not. But nonetheless, that's not the issue. Character matters. Because at the end of the day, you know, the American president is our brand. And I wish Americans would have more humility as we looked around the world right now of how people see us. And that's a real problem. And I think it's analogous to investors in a company. Are you willing to forego bad behavior, unethical behavior, bad character, only for financial returns? Or is there something a little bit more important? And can you not have both? I think the answer is yes, you can have both. But right now, Americans don't get a lot of choices. And this goes back to the political duopoly. We don't have a system that affords Americans enough choice. We also have failed to inspire Americans to participate. So it goes both ways, Jeff. Until Americans vote in primaries, we're going to be limited in our choices. We're handing the keys to the far left, the far right. We're going to get more and more candidates like Donald Trump and Marjorie Taylor Greene and others. And that's the fact of the matter. So it's time for Americans to take some charge as well. And that's a responsibility for all of us.
I'm interviewing the dean of Harvard College soon. What advice do you have for him and for other senior leadership at Harvard and for leaders at other colleges across the country to help them educate and inspire better leaders and better human beings?
Yeah, very simply, you know, we have to re-establish cultures in which one can disagree without being disagreeable. I think that should be, that's the golden rule, right? This is not about
simple. That's simple advice, but really hard to do in practice, right?
Well, it's not hard to do in a private enterprise, and Harvard and, you know, most colleges are. And I think the standards of accountability and behavior are really important. And I think the pendulum has swung a little bit too far in a certain direction. I think it's time to bring it back a little bit. And I didn't learn enough about opposing views in college myself. I recognize that. I would have liked to have been subject to conservative thinkers in auditoriums where I would have been provoked to challenge my own perspectives. And I'm disappointed by the fact that most of my education was generally pretty liberal. And when I say disappointed, not because it wasn't a good education, but I think by definition, it did not open my eyes to other forms of thinking. So why would one expect at age 30, 40, 50, when you're suddenly exposed to a whole group of people that see things differently, we're not prepared. So my advice to Harvard and every other institution is to be very intentional about forcing young people to confront alternative perspectives, opposing views. In high school, I had to do debate. I had to argue against a woman's right to reproductive freedom. And that was discomforting for me because I believed even as a high schooler in reproductive rights. But being forced to make the argument in opposition to your own core beliefs was a very productive exercise. And I think we should force young people to do so. I think people who are disruptive should not have the luxury of being able to be afforded education from those institutions. Because with disruption, by definition, comes the suppression of speech. And I think that is a deeply concerning challenge in our country right now. And let people make decisions for themselves is what I would say. And that means balancing thinking and holding students to very high standards for how they handle themselves in those circumstances. And I don't think there should be any room for those who are not willing to play nice.
So how important and how difficult do you think it is for educators to create this kind of safe space environment where these totally different views can be heard and respected? Right now, obviously, they're failing.
Yeah. Well, I think we have I would argue that this is a problem in politics, too. We've afforded too much power to tenure, not enough to talent. I don't think anybody should be so comfortable that they know they can get away with anything. I think it's unhealthy. So that, that's one. I think a culture of tenure should be addressed. I have proposed term limits for both members of Congress, for the Supreme Court, for even within our Democratic caucus. The Republican conference has 6-year term limits for chairs of committees. And it's a very smart strategy because it creates natural turnover. Mm-hmm. And I think turnover is good in Congress. Democrats, none. It's all tenure.
Why?
People have been around, yeah, because for many, and it makes perfect sense, but for many years, marginalized communities had to accrue power. The only way to do so was through time. That's not the case anymore. And I think we are looking at it incorrectly. I think tenure alone is a real problem. And if you look at politicians, why do we have Mitch McConnell's, Joe Biden's, Nancy Pelosi's, Ruth Bader Ginsburg's, Senator Feinstein's, people who, are in their 80s, who've been there 30, 40, 50 years. It's a real problem because, again, the system rewards sticking around. It doesn't reward independent thinking. It doesn't reward leadership. If you are actually a really good leader mm-hmm. who makes difficult but principled decisions, you're almost certain to lose your job through elections or to not ascend the leadership ladder because you got to play by very different rules, Jeff, and they are antithetical to what I think the country needs. And in some ways, I think the tenure system in education leads to the same thing. People get too comfortable.
Aren't they antithetical to innovation?
Absolutely. There's an inverse correlation between innovation and tenure by definition. You want discomfort. You want provocation. You want new perspectives, new ideas. And, politics is woefully devoid of it. Considering the importance of innovation now more than ever, and in this era, Jeff, in particular, how AI can improve service delivery in government, how it can fundamentally improve healthcare outcomes. Great examples, technologies, people. But right now, there are limitations to even the best managers in the world. Hard to affect a lot of change at the federal government level because of certain contracts, union contracts and the like. And, we've got to have some tough conversations. And that's where I think unions should be on the side of talent, not necessarily tenure. You know what I mean? And I think we have to have that national conversation right now because whether it's teaching in high schools, whether it's federal government work, whether it's universities, a combination. Because when you lose extraordinary people because there's no path for them, we all lose. And unlike any era in human history, young people, because of technology, are better educated in a matter of years than people who lived just half a century ago were educated in their entire lifetimes. And that's the tug of war.
Yeah. And when you have some of these old, like a lot of these older politicians and academics, the younger people are thinking, where's my path?
Yeah,
they
exactly.
Don't see it and they run away.
And they leave. And that's happening in Congress. That's happening in institute. That's happening at institutions of higher education too. You got to make room. God gave us a lifespan. And whether it's 75, 85, 95 years, the fact of the matter is that's the natural cycle is turnover. And I think we create artificial systems that prevent that, certainly in politics. Nobody should be in Washington 50 years like Biden. And furthermore, you know, when you look at the best enterprises that I know, you know, typically 10-year terms for a CEO or a executive director of a museum or a nonprofit, you know, 10 years is an ample amount of time to learn the ropes, make an impact, and then turn it over to others. And if you create that culture, you will thrive into the future. But we've stifled it in way too many ways, particularly in public service.
And that's a long tenure. I mean, as you know, 10 years is fairly long for a
CEO. That's long.
And boards, you know, their most important governance responsibility is CEO succession planning. And they know, yep, you know, that they need to replace the person. In fact, the best boards start thinking about succession the first day the new CEO starts.
And that's there. But there's an inverse correlation in Congress, because, again, the perverse incentive, you are not rewarded for preparing your bench to succeed you, because that bench will overtake you. It'll be a mutiny, right? So there's an incentive to actually limit the amount of information, limit the amount of exposure, limit the amount of preparation, because nobody wants to lose their jobs. And that's why you have leaders like McConnell and Pelosi, both of who served essentially 20 years, 20, in the same leadership positions, denying others the opportunity. So it's very easy to fix, but the problem is the rule makers are the ones rewarded by the status quo.
Yep, and they're in power. And what incentive is there to actually want to switch? So it's not easy.
None. The only way to do it is through grandfathering it in. Look, I served 6 years in Congress. It was wonderful. It was plenty. Even if I hadn't run for president, I would have maybe served one more term. That was it. Because I believe, you know, when I came to Congress, how much more energy and excitement and you know, that get up and go kind of you have. And once you become kind of stuck in, you know, the administrative elements, which is natural, it's time to move on. Now, I look at the Capitol every day I walk to work and I think, holy moly, it still inspires me. But the whole point is to turn it over to someone else now to have their crack at it, right? And the sad truth is in politics, 6 years is like you're still a freshman in high school. You got to be around 10, 15, 20 to even stand a chance of being a committee chair, a leader in your party, because the system is designed to reward tenure.
Are you going to run for president again?
You know, Jeff, I would probably err on the side of not. This was about meeting the moment this time. I got to tell you, though, my love for the country was reinvigorated. I met a lot of extraordinary people who've been encouraging me to give it some thought. I'll see where the country is heading in the next number of years. And, you know, if there's an opportunity and a need, you know, I might do it again. But at this point, I'm going to assess and I'm going to look forward to becoming a private citizen again in January of 25. And pay attention. And if there's a path, perhaps, but not just for doing its sake, it would have to be because the alternatives are not sufficient. So we'll see where things go.
Well, Dean, I've thoroughly enjoyed this conversation. It's gone
thank
in
you.
Directions I didn't really expect, but I hope that you do. And I hope that other
well,
people
you.
Like you throw their hat in the ring. And thank you so much for spending some time with us today, Dean.
Well, thank you. I'm grateful. And I keep the faith and keep in touch. And most of all, keep being decent and thoughtful and empathetic, because boy, our country sure needs it. And that's how, that's why I hope the next leader of this country, one way or another, demonstrates how to do it.
Thank you so much, Dean.
All right. Take care, Jeff. Thanks.
Thank you for listening to another episode of Imperfect Leaders. If you have a question for our guest, feel free to reach out at www.imperfectleaders.com. Until then, we'll see you next week.